by mutos, dregs, primords, field major Styre of the Sontaran Empire, and the bandaged-faced traffic warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels, alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts, though you're only linked to the past, maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics. Brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
Cowering alone in the dark this week is Emma Reeves, an Olivier and Writers Guild Award-winning writer. She works across screen and stage. Her TV credits include The Worst Witch, Android drama for CBBC Eve, which she co-created, The Demon Headmaster, The Dumping Ground, Young Dracula, My Mum Tracy Beaker, and Hard Acres. Her stage work includes her acclaimed adaptation of Jacqueline Wilson's Hetty Feather, Wave Me Goodbye, and The Worst Witch, which won the Olivier Award for Best Family Show in 2020. Emma's adaptation of Jacqueline Wilson's My Mum Tracy Beaker for BBC One and CBBC received a record-breaking reception, reaching 2.1 million streams on iPlayer in its first 3 days, and won the Best Children's TV Episode at the Writers Guild Awards in 2020. But you're listening to a Doctor Who podcast, so you'll likely know Emma's work for Big Finish's Doctor Who, Riversong, Bernice Summerfield, and Torchwood Rangers. Emma, hello.
Hello. Hi.
Great to meet you. Well, great to see you again.
Yeah, you too.
Obviously, we have met several times and know each other. But as I said off mic, well, instead of going straight into your childhood, I think the Big Finish work is a sort of good way in, and one of your choices is a Big Finish. So one thing that struck me is Big Finish isn't, you know, you're a very acclaimed writer, as we've just said. It's actually quite surprising when I was sort of looking into you that your Big Finish credits aren't like ages ago and early on in the range. I think 2019 was Moons of Vulpana, and are there some that are even more recent?
No, Moons of Vulpana is the last one that I've done. Yes, the first one that I was asked to do was Torchwood, and it was one of the first of the Torchwood range, and it was I'm proud and privileged of the fact that it was the first Torchwood audio to take place after the after the sort of the events of Torchwood on TV. And that was Forgotten Live. So yes, that was my first one. And yeah, James Goss asked me to do that in 2015 when I was working on a children's sci-fi show called Eve. And so I was asked to do that. So yes, I sort of came sort of fairly late into Big Finish and haven't done one for a while. I find them very stressful because it's always about shows and characters I love so much. And it's sort of, and it, you know, and it's often tended to happen that I've been asked to do them while I've been doing a lot of other stuff. But you know, the sort of the stress I feel about sort of, you know, being allowed to write. I mean, it's obviously it's incredibly exciting, but it's also incredibly scary because you don't want to sort of mess this up. So I find Big Finish, I think, sort of maybe, you know, I think some of the unkinder fans think, oh, people just churn them out for Big Finish, but no, I found it, you know, an absolute labor of love and therefore a massive stress.
Yeah, as you know, the readers might be recording the day after I've just come back from recording my first Big Finish, which we can't talk about details of, but just being in the studio with director Rob Valentine, who was lovely, but I can't tell you which range it was for or anything because it's not coming out till 2025, it's currently 2023. I know what you mean because you don't do it for the money, shall we say? Yes. They pay, but yes, but it really is. Do you think it's because you're conscious that in that way that when we go to cons and we know these fans that people have had these careers doing a million other things, but it's the Doctor Who credits that everyone in the room knows about, and talked endlessly, and they're like, I can barely remember that day from 1964, but here I am. Do you think it's because part of you is conscious that there will be, like, all your other stuff, lots of, you know, it's brilliant and everyone loves it and people are watching it, but is part of you aware that Doctor Who fans, of which you are one, will, you never know when they might be talking about something that you did years and years ago for Big Finish, and you don't want them to go, oh, why did you put that horrible line in?
Yeah. And you know they will. I mean, yeah. I think it's partly sort of, you know, internalized and externalized fan fear. I think there's like the fear of what the fans will do and say about you, but I think there's also the interior fan of what you'll think of yourself. It's sort of like, you know, don't, you know, I would, you know, because particularly my my first Big Finish was Torchwood for Gwen and Rhys, and you know I absolutely love those characters, and Jack as well was sort of in it in a very Big Finish type way, and it was just I think it was just, you know, the feeling of like, I will hate myself if I mess this up. So it's sort of, so it's just the sort of like the intimidation of put. And then, you know, when I did the Bernice Summerfield, She Met the Unbound Doctor. So that was my first time of typing into TARDIS, which, you know, every writer says just, you know, gives you chills.
Oh, it really sort of is.
And it's mostly exciting chills, but it's also chills of fear. Like, I can't believe the letter. It's a bit like the first time you go out driving after you've passed your test, and the first time you're driving a car on your own, or you know, for people who've got, I don't have children, but people have children, say when they let you take the child home from the hospital, and you're sort of looking around going like, how have they let me do this? Isn't someone going to come and tell me what to do and stop me?
It is strange. I mean, what I did yesterday, because it's so fresh in my mind, it's so surreal, because it's, you know, I've been in lots of professional circumstances, but nothing that tapped into my childhood quite as much as yesterday, when I was acting, you know, unofficially opposite legends, and shouting without giving too much away, shouting something I probably have shouted in the playground since I was two, but shouting it in a booth because Nick Briggs wasn't there. So just to give you a clue as to what I'm,
I think
shouting.
I know what you were
but it's just it's just crazy. I mean, you've actually obviously they always get the writers in to sort of do the odd part. I'm gruff prisoner.
Excellent.
But you've actually got actual credits for actual named characters. Was that something that happened on the day, or were you sort of in as a, you know, were you on the cast list from the beginning as what's your character called in one of them? Is it Eve?
There's Eve Trent. Yes, because Miss Trent is actually not in one of the ones I've written, but I think there may be some. I think there was obviously some sort of recording overlap, and James Gross actually asked me to do that part because she first appeared in Uncanny Valley, which is pretty much a two-hander with John Barrowman and one other actor, and then just like tiny little bits from Miss Trent, and then James Goss wrote a sort of monologue for Miss Trent in the Torchwood archive. So I sort of went in specially to do that. So that was fun.
Oh, wow. Oh, well, that's brilliant. Yeah, because there's so much Big Finish that I haven't listened to much of the Torchwood. Obviously they want everyone to buy every single thing they've ever produced, but it is virtually impossible. So I always, as we'll talk about McGann later, but I haven't missed a McGann since they came out. So that's my, you know, and that's thousands of pounds right there, isn't it? If you think about every McGann, it's crazy. But but your choice of Big Finish is by your friend and mine. Well, I mean, you've known him for years and years and years, and I've only known him a few years, but Joseph Lidster, who seems to know everybody, literally everybody you could ever meet. I think Lisa McMullen said, like she bumped into random people who were like, oh, we know Joe. And I had a similar experience. She knew Joe. They also knew Joe from somewhere else. And I had a similar experience when I was suggesting someone to direct, and the writer I was working with on his play for this audio, he went, well, I was thinking of this guy called Joseph Lidster. I was like, so was I. And it's, I didn't even know my friend liked Doctor Who, but he does. Everyone does, don't they? But yeah, so Master by Joseph Lidster, who we've had on this pod as well. This is from that weird, must have been so, I mean, it was so strange when we had Doctor Who once a month and we didn't know it was coming back. And so you have picked Master by Joseph Lister from 2003. He's 20 years old. So,
yes, I mean,
so of all of them, why this one?
Well, I think I kind of got quite late into Big Finish. I'd been sort of aware of it, and I'd sort of been following the progress of Big Finish through the Doctor Who magazine. And a friend of mine was sort of telling me about sort of something who got to try them, and he very kindly lent me a huge pile of CDs. So I sort of, and I listened to, you know, to a lot of them, and Master was just one which really kind of stuck out for me. And there's just so much like about, I mean, you know, I really liked all the sort of the possibilities. I really liked it as an origin story for the Master. It's interesting because obviously we're going to talk about the Sound of Drums later, which sort of offers an alternate origin story. But I find the origin story offered in Master is I really like it, and I find it very plausible. I really like the Doctor's culpability because I always sort of think, you know, some of the actions that the Doctor does, the extremes the Doctor sort of goes to in very recent times to try to rehabilitate the Master, I sort of feel like if the Doctor felt in some way to blame for what the Master became, that just makes a lot of sense to me. But also, you know, I like the sort of ghost set, ghost story setup. You know, I think, you know, obviously, you know, you've got Jeffrey Beavers having, you know, that wonderful voice. And funnily enough, when we talk, we're obviously going to talk about Derek Jacobi later, but I mean, they've both got a sort of a similarity in sort of some of the ways they approach the Master in terms of that they've just got these, both have got, they've got these just absolutely amazing voices. And obviously Philip Maddox also in it having another amazing voice. So it's just a, you know, it's a great haunting, spooky listen, you know, with quite a lot of sort of meditation on the nature of evil and a very, you know, a backstory for the Master, which I find really compelling.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we'll avoid spoilers for, because...
Oh, sorry.
No. So, no, that's not really a spoiler because you get all that from the... But just in terms of just massive spoilers, it's best to avoid, isn't it? But just because it is available for $2.99.
Yes,
which is an absolute bargain. I mean, there's, you know, and also if you've got a Spotify subscription, it's there as one of the first 50s, and it's absolutely brilliant. Mm. It really is. I know they couldn't do it now, but I kind of miss the music kicking in every half an hour as well.
Yes,
the episode structure.
Yes, I did think that when I bought it on Audible recently to re-listen, and I thought yes, I had to miss the sort of
Yeah, and everything being built for that structure. But just giving it a re-listen. And I love the fact that it's McCoy's Doctor as well, sort of telling a story to an assassin, which we won't sort of go into. But so then it's got, in brilliant, you know, Joseph Lidster style, it's got lots of different layers because it is about the nature of storytelling and, as you say, the nature of evil and guilt. And then it gets into the sort of continuity and, you know, and a sort of, I guess what we must now describe as an alternative origin story for the Master. Yes. But you know, there is no real canon. It's all, do you like this story right now?
and I think, to be honest, you could absolutely fit it in with the Sound of Drums explanation and say both happened quite easily.
So. Yeah, oh, totally. I mean, there are ways of fitting everything in, really, aren't there? I think your sort of comparisons to Jacobi as well. I like the Master when he's sneaky and when he's got that human side, or when he's more, because Jacobi always says he's it's Mads Mikkelsen's Hannibal. That's one of his jumping off points for playing the Master.
Oh, interesting.
So the fact that he's pretending to be nice, but anyone who's switched on can tell there's something off about him, but still trusts him and doesn't quite know how depraved he is. And what he will do. But yeah, that's why I love the War Master stories, because you get tricked into thinking he's the Doctor.
Yes.
Even though you know he's not the Doctor and he's calling himself the Master, but that you, like the people he's with, you get tricked into thinking he's the Doctor saving them all. And then towards the end, you realize he was just using them, or even sometimes just toying with them for the for his own amusement. Yeah. And it's a brilliant little a little twist on the sort of on the usual Doctor Who.
Yes.
We're going to get out of some trouble here, because there's always that extra, you know, knife in the gut at the end kind of thing. But
it's weird because I had so many things that I wanted to pick, and then you know, when I was choosing my final five, I almost sort of picked at random, and I just realized that I've picked, you know, this and Utopia, and I sort of come to realize how much those stories have got in common, because you both got a beautifully voiced master who doesn't realize he's the master.
Yeah.
But I hope it's not too much of a spoiler, because I think again that's pretty much in the blurb. And but I think what the sort of four part what Master has a chance to do on audio is to sort of really explore the tragedy of, like, he really didn't know he was the master. He thought he could build a new life, but you know, he can't, because he's steeped in blood. And of course, the similar sort of things happen to the Doctor. But there isn't really, much as I love everything about Utopia, Sound, Drum, etc., there's not really time to explore in that the sort of the tragedy of the sort of the death of the Derek Jacobi character and the Professor Professor Yana. It's like, you know, Professor Yana was a lovely bloke.
Well, that's why I think Big Finish, the War Master series is so welcome by a lot of them, because I was like, oh my god. I mean, we'll talk about this later, but I was like, oh my goodness, Jacobi is the master. Yes, that's perfect. Oh, he's John Sim. so it was absolutely wonderful, and nothing against John Sim, but I would have been fine with Jacobi carrying on screen for a little bit longer as the master. But but we now get millions of box sets of him being delicious.
Free on DVD with issue 6 of Warp Warp.
I stopped the car at last and let the fog close in around
me. Brand new animation by Mel.
I knew I was somewhere on Barnes Common, and I had a suspicious idea it was the most deserted part as well.
Adapted from the opening chapter of Doctor Who and the Daleks by David Whittaker.
I'm Barbara. Barbara Wright. Susan. Susan's in the road.
A meeting on the common.
Oh my goodness.
I say, you there. Are you trying to get us all killed? There's petrol everywhere.
Featuring Stephen Noonan.
What are you doing here?
As the First Doctor. Out now. Order online at warpwarp.co.uk.
But before we get onto your Jacobi, we'll do the lying down on the couch bit. So, Doctor Who, your childhood, when did it intersect with your life? And how much did it make you the person and the writer you are?
I mean it's hard to sort of know what sort of makes you who you are, but you know, it's interesting because, like, I sort of, when I was sort of, I mean, you know, actually I was actually born in the year that Tom Baker took over, so obviously I, you know, I couldn't have remembered the early Tom Bakers, but you know, he literally had been the Doctor as far as I could ever remember. And of course, so when my very early childhood was at the absolute peak of Doctor Who's 70s popularity, and you know, and I remember it being on after the football scores, and it just being this thing, you know, my parents weren't sci-fi fans, but Doctor Who would be on and they'd watch it. And I've got this early memory of my mum and dad going to a fancy dress party as the Fourth Doctor and K-9. And I think, you know, the memory sort of lingered, because, like,
who was who?
The costume that they had, sort of, you know, the K-9 sort of silver sprayed box was in the garage for years, and the my dad's curly wig that he wore as the Doctor, I think, is still sort of kicking around in my parents' house in sort of dressing up cupboards. So it's I sort of remember it being like, it was, you know, it was huge. It was just like part of the national conversation, if you like. It was just sort of like, you know, so I remember when it was announced that Tom Baker was going to regenerate, I just couldn't get my head around it. My mum had to explain, oh no, there have been lots of them. And so it's interesting with Doctor Who sort of coming back, and this sort of, like, this, it feels, you know, this very sort of bold agenda to sort of make it a huge thing. Because I think in my head, that's what sort of TV Doctor Who should be. It should be a sort of huge popular thing for everyone. And, you know, then, you know, there's plenty of room for more niche things, which, and of course, I know that Russell T. Davis's plans are to do that too. So like, it was always, yeah, it was kind of just always there. And but then I started, like most people of my age, I then started getting the Target books from the secondhand shop and the library, and I would go back to the library and borrow them again. You know, the usual story. because of course, you know, it was things weren't regularly repeated in those days, of course. So you know, you got to know most of the stories through the Target novelizations. So
yeah, exactly the same. I'm just a touch older than you, and exactly. I don't remember anything other than Tom till the trauma.
Yes,
it was even used as a, because we had to go to chapel when I was in Yorkshire, and it was even used in the sermon the day after the Sunday following Logopolis.
They
used it to say, "We're all sad, somebody's gone, but he's almost like he's born again, and he's Peter Davison, and you're all going to enjoy Peter Davison, and this isn't that just like Jesus?" And it was, but I just remember, oh, that's the first, you know, just to sit there going, "God, I hate chapel," and that was the one time I remember. And another time they mentioned Daleks. I think the minister might have been a doctor. They mentioned Daleks and the nature of evil and the fact that they, after destiny, the fact that they'd obey unquestionably. So there were some weird memories from a Yorkshire Methodist childhood. But yeah,
what did the minister think of the Daleks' message of obey unquestioningly? Because surely they want you to obey Jesus unquestioningly, but
I know, but I think
them with the Daleks, it's not a good idea.
Yeah, I think he was more leaning into the sort of the Nazi analogy and obeying orders. Yeah. But I think it was also just to make children go, "Oh, I'm listening."
Ooh, Daleks, yeah.
Yeah, because they're the two sermons I remember when I sat through thousands during my childhood, just doodling on pads. God, it's strange how Doctor Who is so much part of the British DNA, isn't it?
Yes.
And childhood and will be again. So your choice from that era is presumably not one you watched on transmission, because you was not conceived.
I did borrow it again and again from Wrexham Library. But Genesis of the Daleks, and I know a lot of people have picked Genesis of the Daleks, but
yeah.
I sought your permission specifically for Genesis because
you've got it's your rest of your life in a bunker. So you've got to have Genesis of the Daleks.
Well, exactly.
It's not a very cheery one because it's set in a bunker.
It's true, but then it's sort of like my bunker hopefully won't be full of Daleks. So I think, you know, I'll always think things could be worse. Can't have the rest of your life without Genesis of the Daleks. But no, I particularly wanted to pick this, even though I know everyone picks it, because my 12-year-old nephew who lives in Canada, he's sort of a natural Doctor Who fan. He's sort of, you know, loved it since I can remember. You know, he loves all the Doctors. He, you know, is very excited about all of it. But he's been asking me, and he was asking me when he was over this summer about his going, like, "I hear there's an origin story for Davros." And I was going, "Well, how do you mean an origin story? There are several." But but he was like, "But how did Davros invent the Daleks?" And I was like, "Oh, you want Genesis of the Daleks?" And he insisted he wanted to watch. And I didn't, you know, I don't want kids to be disappointed, and I don't want me to be disappointed. So I was warning him, like, remember, this was made in the 70s. You'll probably find it sort of slow moving and think that the sets aren't very good and stuff. But he insisted he wanted to watch. So we watched it. Mm-hmm. And he was just absolutely hooked. And I think he turned to me after a couple of and just accusingly saying, "This isn't slow moving." And I was like, "No, well, of course it's not. And that just shows the folly of anticipating what children won't like and putting words into their mouths. Because then anyway,
managing expectations.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to do. But anyway, he absolutely loved it. And then Revenge of the Cybermen came up next, which is obviously, you know, one of the less well-regarded series. But, you know, he really wanted to watch that too. So we watched that. So, this was just a lovely, happy memory. But I'm just, you know, delighted to report that that the younger generation, it's still got it, Genesis of the Daleks. But, I mean, as you say, it's a dark story, and it's you know, it's a morally complex story, because at one point he said to me, so are the Thals the goodies? And I thought, oh, no, and you just wait to see what the Thals do. Because, you know, everyone talks about the Germans as the Nazi analogues, but then the Thals go around kidnapping people they believe are genetically inferior and working them to death. So, you know.
And they're the ones that are blonde and blue-eyed as well.
Yes.
So, I always think it's been there from the beginning. The Thals are peaceful when we first meet them in Dalek, the dead planet.
Yeah.
But they remember being warlike, so it was always there.
Yes,
they were certainly warlike by the end of it.
Yes. Because it's interesting, isn't it? I was thinking about, like, are the mutants created by, because it's the Thals, as we're originally told in the Daleks, that set off a nuclear bomb, isn't it, or a radiation, who started the nukes? Are the mutes created? Like, is that because of the Thals bombs or Davros's meddling? I guess it's a bit of both. But it's sort of like the Thals are incredibly culpable, which is kind of what's so juicy and dramatic about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, everyone does seem to still forget that the one thing they do is they kill every Khaled.
Yeah.
With their missiles.
Yes.
They kill millions and millions of Khaleds.
Only the Daleks are left. A missile built by enslaved people.
So, yeah. I mean, that's one of the fascinating things about the Daleks is they are this... On one hand, they're a silly pop thing. On another hand, they are experience of World War II mixed with fear of Armageddon. And so they are World Wars 2 and 3 sort of in silly sci-fi form, which is they're just such a I almost say you couldn't make them up, but somebody obviously did.
Somebody did.
But several people and deadlines and that magic of writing. So they just seem like they've always been, and they seem real until you think about them for 2 seconds and they're silly. But they weren't, you know, they were technically designed by committee, weren't they? Because all these different people came in, but done such inspired, well, this just needs to happen, that needs to happen. And the core of them, they just work so well. But if they were trying to design a toy, they wouldn't have looked like that, because every single Dalek's got three things to be snapped off. So they're the least perfect toy. Seeing that I live in a house with snapped Daleks, I've got an 8-year-old, a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old, and they've all been through Daleks, and they all need new Daleks buying every time they get into it, because the others are all snapped. But Doctor Who being for kids, we were sort of saying before we started recording just how I think it's at its best when it's big, like it was for the first four Doctors. It was playgrounds and families where Doctor Who lived, and through no fault of the, you know, it's just times changing. But I guess I remember it tailing off in the Davison eras when the BBC started slowly killing it.
Looking around with the scheduling.
Yeah, I had to drop out of Cubs or Scouts to watch Doctor Who, which was not popular with my parents. And it's like, if it stayed on Saturday, I could have done both, but it didn't.
Yeah.
So, the fact that it was starting to get buried and suddenly I became one of the only people that liked Doctor Who in the classroom, whereas before everyone, it just something we all watched. And then into Colin and then into the wilderness years of Colin and McCoy, it just, you know, it was still the show we love, but it wasn't popular at all. I mean,
yeah, so it was just a thing sort of, you know, for years I kind of quietly liked on my own. And then
I think
when I was about 16 in youth theatre, I met sort of a fellow fan. And at the time I lived in Wrexham, and
it's not far from me. I'm in Cheshire, near Winsford.
The time of the Llangollen Museum. So, you know, with its Dalek road signs and stuff. So sort of, you know, and that's not far from us. So we used to go there, and then like buy tat at the Dapple factory. that was next door. And then when I went to uni, it's funny, I sort of met and now this sounds like name dropping, they'll just be like Peter Harness, and and I realized that he was, you know, we were doing this play together, a production of Hamlet, and we realized that we were big Doctor Who fans, so we sort of bonded over that. And then Matthew Sweet, who was doing a PhD and had his own flat, he had a huge array of VHSs. So Matthew Sweet lent me a lot. So a lot of the classic series that I saw for the first time was because Matthew Sweet lent me the DVDs.
Oh, wow.
Matthew Sweet from the radio. So now.
Yeah. No, Matthew, he's someone I've obviously known of for years, not just because of him appearing on extras on Blu-rays, but his shows on Radio 3 are absolutely wonderful.
Yes,
and not just when they talk about not just when he's talking about Doctor Who, which he does a lot, but I now know him vaguely from going to Gallifrey 1 and things like that, and he's a lovely man, but I've sort of said to him, it's like, how often do you put Doctor Who into a script for one of your Radio 3 things? And he went, every single one, and I have to take it out, because there's a brilliant episode of on Varney the Vampire, which is like this 19th century thing, which was written by about 100 different writers, became this great big canon. It was really popular over several decades. And I just remember listening to it going, at some point he's going to say, this is like Doctor Who, isn't it? Because it's written by a million people. And then I said, but he doesn't. And he went, yes, exactly. It's like Doctor Who from the 19th century. It was a great big popular, big sprawling thing. It's canon, you know, various hacks of various different talents, varying talents, all put their mark on this show, and it became this huge sprawling thing about a vampire across the centuries. And it's wonderful thing about Varney the Vampire, and so popular at the time. But just the parallels with something like Doctor Who or Star Trek, which are the work of hundreds of writers and creatives, and we end up with this weird canon that doesn't quite fit, which is just, you know, which is why we can endlessly talk each other's socks off about why things don't fit and why things don't work, which sort of neatly brings me on to the discontinuity guide, which is wonderful. I remember reading this when it first came out, and for me it's just the right kind of attitude to Doctor Who, because it's not taking it too seriously, but they really know their stuff. But by Paul Cornell and Keith Topping and Martin Day. I did write them down, but I always just remember as Paul Cornell on it, because I know him vaguely. Well, not vaguely, I know him quite well now, again from cons. So why the discontinuity guide?
Well, because as I was sort of explaining, and I'd never been sort of part of organized fandom, I used to read Doctor Who magazine. But I sort of, you know, and I sort of felt I knew there was a sort of community out there, but I always sort of felt that I would be never, you know, not sort of knowledgeable enough or sort of worthy of taking part. So it was something I kind of, you know, mostly enjoyed on my own. And then, you know, and then I met a couple of like-minded people like Peter Harness and Matthew Sweet. But it was, I think, you know, I was thinking, because it came out in 95 and I would have just been finishing uni around that time. Mm-hmm. And I think what was sort of so crucial about it, because there's an intro to Terence Dix, which sort of just describes the perfect, an intro by Terence Dix, which sort of describes the sort of, you know, the way of looking, because it's sort of like poking gentle fun. It's sort of like, it's very erudite about Doctor Who, but it also allows people to take the piss a bit. And I think it's just the sort of, it was just the kind of attitude I was looking for. And I think what's crucial is, like, there was no internet in those days, or it was in its infancy, but like there was a computer room in college, and I never went in there because that was just for, like, you know, serious computer people. And so, you know, it was so just reading, you know, and it had a description of every single story, but very entertainingly so. But and, you know, a lot of like, yes, I thought that, you know, so I think it was, so it's just this sort of like, the perfect sort of positive but funny kind of view of fandom, which actually, and I was sort of, you know, and I think there are plenty of now, and so there are plenty of blogs and sites and people you can follow who would give you that sort of content, but of course it wasn't there at time. But also I think what's nice about having it in the book, and the book I've got by me now is, I think I've got an old one in Wrexham as well, but I've bought it so many times over the years. I bought it as presents to people, because I thought people, you know, should read it. And I'm delighted to announce to your listeners that it's available on Kindle now as well.
So, oh, wow.
But it was just, but I think, and you know, and I also, and things like, you know, years later, Rob Sherman and Toby Haydock's Running Through Corridors. Yeah. That's another, I think it's, you know, it's sort of, in a way, it's sort of funny sitting down and reading a book where you could get similar sorts of, you know, you get all the information and many, many takes on it in the internet. But I think what's nice about reading a book is sort of, it's finding like these voices and this attitude that you like. Whereas like if you went on the internet and a discussion forum, yes, you'd get that, but you'd also be bombarded with negativity. And sometimes, sometimes you just want to go, I'm in the hands of some clever, funny people that I trust, and I just want to read their take on things.
Yeah, no, it's a lovely thing. It's weird thinking back then, so it's pre-internet, because I was just graduated and trying to being on the dole and just going out too much as well. But also the one side of me, I didn't know many Doctor Who fans, but I was trying to write like Virgin New Adventures and submitting, mm-hmm. and I've, you know, all these massive manuscripts and that you know, and getting nice rejection letters and that sort of early. But it was hard. But you know, buying the Universal Data Bank,
that great big thing
that had all the had all the stories in it, and then fitting that into, like, you know, like submitting stories that were way too continuity heavy, and strange, and on an Amstrad as well. So on an Amstrad with a disc, and then I got burgled and didn't have a computer for years, which was awful. But yeah, so that was it's hard being a writer in the 90s,
yes.
without a computer and without the internet and all those things. But yeah, but it's just it was a strange time looking back, Doctor Who wise, because it's now taken over my life bit by bit. And but back then it was just me, and people knew I liked Doctor Who, but they didn't like Doctor Who. But if I had a birthday, they'd probably buy me something with a Dalek on it or something as a joke.
Yes.
But it was strange. But when did you start going to conventions? Because I always look back and go, maybe I should have gone to more conventions earlier, but I didn't, because I was a dope smoking hippie with dreadlocks. So it wasn't really on my radar.
So, I mean, I never really went to conventions. The first thing that I went, but I do remember going to the 50th at the Excel. And that was of the, you know, and then the 52nd, and I've sort of been to a couple of big Finnish days, and I've been to Galley now as well,
which is quite
an experience.
I've been that to was, the past it was, two.
It was 2020, so it was just before COVID hit.
Oh, February.
In fact, I'm fairly sure I caught COVID there. Worth it.
So we went when it was cut away. We sort of went there, and we're basically going to go to everyone now till it stops, because it's every time we go there, we people expect us to be there, our American film, yes. and we make our flights back instantly with the queue before we've even properly opened, and then. The 50th, I guess, before we get on to the 50th, is now here we are at time of recording. It's November the 1st. So we are 25 days away from the next era of Doctor Who starting. And I'm starting to get excited like I haven't been in such a long time. But before that, let's go back to, like, what was it like when Doctor Who came back for you?
I mean, I think it's interesting, because I think a lot of sort of fans will feel, because it's sort of, as I was saying, like in my childhood, it was this huge thing. It was just, you know, something which people who weren't even sci-fi fans watched. And then it became nicher. And it was just sort of, you know, a thing which I enjoyed. And I had a couple of friends who were also really into it. And it was like of our private thing. And I think a lot of fans, I felt a lot of trepidation about it. I was just sort of, I was sort of thinking, you know, is this, because I think sort of, a lot, I think like the world at large, I haven't exactly forgotten Doctor Who, but like you say, it was sort of like, I just have, you know, loads of sort of Doctor Who themed tat, which people have given me for birthdays and Christmas over the year. Cause like, oh, Emma's the one who likes Doctor Who, we'll get her this. and people are like, oh, aren't you glad your show is coming back? And I think I think sort of ghost light sort of expresses sort of really well this sort of the negative side of the Doctor Who sort of attitude to, like, you know, do we want more? Do we want change? It's sort of like, because we've sort of got used to, you know, we had these 697 was it episodes that were sort of, that was our thing. And you know, did we want it to change? Did we want? And I remember, but as so I was excited but nervous. things I remember is Doctor Who magazine saying that, and it was just like a parent going, right, we've got guests, so be good, won't you? And there was an editorial saying, like, from now on we will be referring to Doctor Who producer John Nathan Turner, not JNT, and we will be. And I remember that the magazine for the first time literally had a spine rather than, because it used to just have a couple of staples in. So it was sort of like, it's a big, like, things are happening, but, like, obviously I think everyone was like, oh, will this be a huge disaster? But it was, yes, it was a huge thing. And I suppose rather like now with the return of Russell T. Davis and the coming of Shuti Gatwa and the return of David Tennant, it's we've been waiting years. So it's sort of like it was announced and then it sort of took a long time till actually yeah. we got to see it. So there was, you know, a couple of years of fevered speculation. But what a triumph. And then
please don't be shit.
Please don't be shit. And then it kind of, or if you are shit, just go away quickly.
Yeah.
was my super pessimistic.
I mean, I had a feeling that it was going to be good because, I mean, you will have, you know, as someone in the biz, you'll have known this as well. Like, Russell T. Davis was already, yes. to those of us that follow these things, Russell T. Davis was already, I mean, Queer as Folk was yeah. just one of yeah. the best things I'd ever seen, like, kind of changed my life in lots of ways. And yeah, so I already knew, and Bob and Rose, so I already knew him as a writer. And also, obviously, I'd probably been turned onto him as a writer because he'd done a new adventure and stuff like that.
Yes.
So, yes, I was already quietly confident that, yes. you know.
Well, you were right, and I was relieved to be wrong. But I mean, I think what I couldn't have predicted was that it would so recapture the glory days of Tom, in that sort of, you know, it yeah. would sort of get everyone watching, talking about it, and, you know, including non-sci-fi fans, normal people. You know, it was sort of...
Oh, I just remember people talking about it in the pub, and I was like, are they talking about Coronation? No, they're talking about Doctor Who. So it was in the same way people talk about the soaps, they were talking about, you know, in that brilliant way, yes. where everyone has a bit of a gossip about characters we all know. They were talking about David Tennant and Billy Piper, and it was like, oh my god, what's
I think you're right. And I think he you know, Russell gets a lot of credit, but it still isn't enough, because it's interesting, because people have said, you know, because I think, you know, to be I was pessimistic last time, I'll be optimistic this time. I think people always say times have changed, you know, you can't get huge up, but, you know, I think there is an element of, if you build it, they will come, because, like, as someone who was working in TV at the time, you know, people, not me, were just like, Russell's off his rocker. I know he had to fight for that Saturday evening slot. And people were like, no one wants to watch family drama on a Saturday evening. But they did when Doctor Who came back. And you know, and then he kind of created, and then you got things like Strictly. So it's sort of like he kind of created, you know, there was a whole sort of world of Saturday nights, which felt like it had gone out 40 years ago, but he brought it back. Yeah. In a good way. And it's interesting, yeah, yeah. like, you know, other shows tried to follow on the Saturday night family drama with varying success. And then
Primeval, I'm still a big fan of.
Yeah.
I loved Primeval.
And Merlin and yeah. Robin Hood, which I enjoyed a lot.
So, oh, yeah, yeah. You know, well, so I'm your friend Lisa. Well, Lisa. Yeah, so she was growls when you mentioned Merlin.
Why?
because I think Merlin came along and knocked Robin Hood out.
I think
one made Merlin, Robin Hood made way for Merlin, and Robin Hood was carried on. But
you know, but Russell reestablished this territory of Saturday, you know, because everyone said, oh, it can't be. Because I think sort of, I believe things go in cycles, or, you know, you can bring things back. I think some people are very sort of like keen to go, oh, that was the past, it'll never work again. Whereas Russell was like, no, it can work again. And yeah. she proved it could. And then they tried other family dramas in that slot and, you know, eventually gave up. But I think Russell's going to bring, it's just because I feel like I'm so old now, and now Russell's going to bring Doctor Who back to Saturday nights, and people are going, oh yeah, but times have changed. Nobody will watch family drama on Saturday nights. And I'm like, well, that's what they said 20 years ago.
So, I know. And you know. There's that constant snobbery, which Russell's talked about, and you're so right, but snobbery against science fiction.
That drives me mad.
Like I always remember when he said, they were mad. They got this amazing Star Trek Generations and they buried it on BBC Two. They could have stuck that on Saturday night and it would have been like Dynasty or Dallas was in the 80s. And and people would have watched it, but they just them upstairs don't like it, do they? They want to stick a they just watch. I always get the impression they just watch the Stephen Polyarkov and they don't watch anything else. I mean, even against Stephen Polyarkov, but they like that feels fancy to them. And then some of them, and all the rest of it's programming that they don't watch.
Interesting within the BBC, everyone, it's very BBC, everyone's always pointing the fingers. They're going like, oh, well, personally, I like sci-fi, but the person above me doesn't. Yeah. Everyone's pointing the finger. And, you know, I have heard somebody very high up indeed doesn't like sci-fi, which is where the buck stops, Charlotte Moore. I think that's fair to say. She's everybody. but it seems ludicrous that one person, no matter how senior, can put the kibosh on sci-fi for the nation.
Yeah, well, but I also think it's not just it's so popular. I mean, the writers' room, BBC writers' room, I love it. It's brilliant. It's, you know, changed my life, supporting me early on. But the two big things, really big things that came out of the writer's room were one was In the Flesh, which was horror, and the other one was Wolfblood, werewolves and stuff. So it's like, yeah, we're doing all these things, but genre taps into the general public.
Out now from Cutaway Comics, part two of the Gods and Monsters saga.
And so I am banished.
Sutek.
Robbed of physical form. Set adrift in the black void between galaxies. Not for the first time. For I am Sutek. Destroyer. Sworn enemy of all creation. And creation has many defenders. But this defeat feels different. Something new gnaws at what remains of my diminished soul. Not merely defeat, but something I dare not even name.
Sutek. Sutek, hear me.
Next, this.
Yes, O brother husband. Let my voice guide you back to me and home to Neticatet.
The land of the dead. And yet, for me, it means life, a reprieve, and for the first time in millennia, a body.
In this place, you will always have form, or the appearance of form. But this you know. I have been granted permission to save you, but not restore you.
You always were weak, sister wife. Sentimental. The others would have let me die.
And they would have been justified in doing so. You were brought into this universe to bring chaos and suffering and death, but as part of the greater whole, you played a role in the balance of all things. And then, brother, husband, you forgot your place.
I declared war on all life.
You went insane, Even I, my love, wish death upon you. Only now...
You need my insanity.
Yes.
Who do you want me to kill?
An animated version of this trailer, starring Gabriel Wolf as Sutek and Zoe Iqbal as Nephthys, is one of the features on the VAM disc that comes free with the comic, only when you purchase direct from us at cutawaycomics.co.uk.
I've generously, because you're the choice that will come finally, your final choice is 10 minutes long. So, yeah. So I've generously let you have a massive, massive amount of New Who episodes, because they are technically in the same story. But we have Utopia, as we mentioned before. So we start with Utopia, and then we go on into Sound of Drums and Last of the Time Lords. So it was a wonderful, wonderful time when that Utopia. So why Utopia? And two after it.
Well, I mean, you know, so Doctor Who came back, and then, you know, it quickly sort of became that sort of, you know, recreated the high point of the Tom era. It sort of, you know, it was huge. It was, as you said, everyone was talking about it. Non sci-fi fans were watching it, and I, you know, I particularly remember that summer of that finale, because my sister was getting married, and you know, despite, you know, not having sort of previously been a Doctor Who fan, we were all watching it as a family. And I remember at her wedding, she asked for I Can't Decide by the Scissor Sisters from the wedding DJ. And it was just sort of like, it was just a feeling of we're all watching this together. And so, you know, I mean, I just love absolutely everything about that episode. I mean, you know, and I think there's, and I think what Russell does so brilliantly is sort of like, with the scale of the Master's Conquest, there's a lot of hand waving and a lot of, you know, I'm sure if he's to novelize it, there'll be a lot of more sort of details of that. It's sort of like, yeah, but how exactly? But that doesn't matter, I don't think, because what he never does hand wave is the characters and the emotions.
Yeah.
So, and I think, you know, and I think Martha, I love Martha as a companion. Mm. And I think her bravery in walking away from the Doctor is just, and that, you know, and sort of being so honest and open about her feelings is just so brave and so beautiful. And you know, as I mentioned before, Derek Jacobi's performance as the Master, John Sims' performance as the Master, it's all brilliant. But I think that summer to me sort of just reminds me of Doctor Who's sort of second huge peak of popularity. Around about then, but and of course that sort of, you know, chimes in really well with Martha going around the world and getting everyone to chant the name Doctor. I think,
yeah,
it felt like, you know, people have a lot of opinions about that. I love it personally, but and it also felt like that's what's happening at the time. You know, the Doctor was becoming so huge. I think it's interesting, you're talking about Queer as Folk before, and it's funny because what Martha does, and I suppose just because Russell is so good, he can write anything brilliantly. But like in Queer as Folk, one of my favourite moments is the end of Queer as Folk, when we know that, is it Vince the main character?
Yeah.
He knows that he should give up the sort of sexy, charismatic man who's only going to break his heart and stick with his sensible boyfriend. But instead he throws his mobile phone in the canal and runs off to chase the sexy and obtainable guy. And, you know, in Russell's hand, that's a sort of a brilliant triumph and a screw you to the world. And funnily enough, Martha does the exact opposite at the end of Last of the Time Lords. And that also feels like a triumph from Martha. So how you write things.
Yeah, it totally is. You can, as I was saying to Lisa McMullen the other day, you can literally write anything if you do it right, can't you? There's no...
really true.
People always go on about structure working in this certain way, and it's, but you can literally make anything work as a writer. It's why it's endlessly fascinating to analyze. Use structure, usually instinctively rather than planning it, but you use expectations in one way or another, and you can make any single outcome dramatically pleasing if you if you get it right. And my God, Russell is the master, yeah. As you just the master, as you rightly say. But that era as well is really, I've got a real memory of watching Utopia live, and it really, because I was back home, and I wasn't for any of the others, but my parents were watching it.
Do you know what? That's the rich, so was I. And similarly, I was watching it with my mum and dad, which,
yeah,
again, you know, wasn't something that had happened since the 1970s. And they were watching
same
it with
me.
And when Derek Jacobi produced the Fob Watch, I was obviously just off the on the edge of my seat, and I was like, "Oh my God, he's the master! Oh no, wait, maybe he's Romana, or maybe he's Barusa, and maybe he's the Rani." And I was just getting all getting overthinking myself and getting all excited. I just remember my dad turning to me going, "What was that first one you said?" And I went, "The master," and he goes, "It'll be that." And my dad was correct.
Oh, so. My God. Well, my story is similar, but it's because it was Jacobi. They were watching it anyway.
Yes.
Just since it came back, they went, well, we'll give it a chance. And it was obviously, yes, scheduled, because when it became Matt Smith, it was opposite something else. They didn't like turn off because they didn't want to, but they just stopped watching. They just didn't go back to it. But that period, it was what they watched. They always went through, watched everything live, obviously, back then, and circled stuff. And it was always Doctor Who, circle it, we're going to watch Doctor Who. And they just loved it. But it was weird watching that, because it was Jacobi, and Jacobi is such a big part of our life. Because when I was, I said this when I met Derek Jacobi recently, we had a cat when I remember watching I, Claudius as a kid, because my parents were quite liberal when it came to stuff like that. So I was watching I, Claudius when it went out, and Jacobi's like going, Claudius, and crawling across the floor. And our little kitten was doing the same thing. So I got to tell him that, and he hooted with laughter that our cat got called Claudius. We had that cat for 15 years after that, and it was cool. But just Jacobi being a huge part of our life. And then my dad even hired Derek when he worked. He ran a film unit. He worked for the BBC, then he ran a film unit for the Open University. Then he ran a film unit for the RAF, of all things. Because my dad also had a military background, so it was like his perfect job. TV and TV, film and military, yes, all in one. He had a rank, and he was a film producer, so he loved it. But he hired Derek for one of those sort of corporate promos, and it won awards and stuff, which Derek also remembered doing. It was like 20 odd years ago. But yeah, but just so we were particularly, it just seems so weird. We were particularly engaged because it was Derek Jacobi. But then it made me realize how much Doctor Who, my parents didn't watch it. You know, it was on. And my dad even like made the TARDIS disappear in the 60s when he was first a film assistant. Film editor.
Wow.
So, during a Troughton, and we don't know which one, but it was, you know, because he wasn't credited, it was just what you got to do. It was one of your rites of passage as a film editor. I'll go make the TARDIS disappear, and it would go out on TV. But we think it was the Dominators, because it was the way he's described it, and it was definitely Troughton. cliffs by the TARDIS, by some cliffs. Anyway, but it just made me realise, you know, my dad doesn't know Doctor Who. He's never read a Doctor Who novel. He doesn't know everything. But when the Fob Watch came out, my dad went, "He's the master." And I didn't even know he knew what the master was.
Gosh, our dads. However many miles apart, just both go to the master.
and it really brought home how that first era,
yes,
had someone who wasn't even a fan. In a bit the same way that everyone knows the names of classic Coronation Street characters,
yes,
whether you've watched it or not properly, you just kind of know them like they're real people.
Yeah.
The same thing had happened with Doctor Who. So my dad, like 2006 or whatever it was, 2006, 2007, was absolely, it's the master, and was into the lore of it without even knowing he was. And he was spot on. It was such an amazing moment. It was like, it's the master. I think, like I said earlier on, I just wish that nothing against John Sim, but it would have been nice to have Jacobi be the master for on screen a little bit.
Yeah, it really would.
Oh dear, no. Well, this really isn't good enough. Suffering satellites, I've travelled across time and space to face you, and now that I'm here, nothing. Aren't you even going to threaten to exterminate me, you know, with your ray gun sticks? Come along, come along. Can't you poke your eye stalks out of issue 6 of Warp Warp? That's issue 6 of Warp Warp, the acclaimed Doctor Who fanzine, to present me with a bit of daring do. Some excitement, for pity's sake. I guess I can't blame them. I mean, it does celebrate 60 years of an unearthly child with a new interview with Carol Ann Ford, graphic reconstructions of the sets from Doctor Who's very first story, an extensive interview with Mark Gatiss about an adventure in space and time, plus Clive Doig, Brian Hodgson, comic strips, and oh, so much more. Heaven knows how they fit it all in. Do you know, I might take a look myself. Oh, yes. Yes, most exciting. All this plus a free disc containing, among other treats, a dynamic 18-minute animation of the much-loved alternative opening to Doctor Who, as told to David Whittaker in his classic 1964 novelization, Doctor Who in an Exciting Adventure with the Daleks. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, you see, we're all now too engrossed in this super new issue. There'll be no excitements from me or these Tin Terrors today. No deadly exterminations. Well, you know what they say. All thwop and no slay. Purchase your copy from whopwhop.co.uk now.
Great that Big Finish are doing the War Master. But because they are, anyone who hasn't listened to those, they're a particularly strong strand of Big Finish, I think, because they've got Derek at the centre, and he taps into he uses Mads Mikkelsen's Hannibal as his sort of starting point master, which I think is wonderful, which is why I think he's one of my favourite incarnations of the Master. As a result, brilliant. Much like, to neatly segue into your final choice, much like Paul McGann is one of my favourite Doctors because of his work on Big Finish. But you have chosen not a Big Finish, McGann. You have chosen Knight of the Doctor, which is an amazing moment, wasn't it?
I thought it would balance out, you know, Utopia and Sound of Drums. I think it was sort of with choosing these, I think, you know, as I was saying, there were so many other things I could have chosen it almost. But I think a lot of the ones I've chosen have sort of remind, you know, because of, you know, obviously being in this bunker. And I think I've sort of chosen ones which also sort of remind me of the sort of the context and the wider world and, you know, and connections with friends and family. And I think the Knight of the Doctor was just the 50th anniversary was such an exciting time to be a Doctor Who fan. And I just remember it was a Thursday, and then there's this sort of message that was going around, like, something is going to happen at 12 p.m. and we just didn't know what. And then everyone was going, like, just go to the site. I won't tell you what happens, just go. And so, yes, the Doctor, but probably not the one you're expecting. And it's Paul McGann. And I think it's sort of because I think we're all sort of aware, I think Stephen Moffat has talked about it very openly, going back to the BBC not really getting sci-fi, that he wanted Paul McGann originally for Day of the Doctor. Yeah. And, you know, apparently the BBC unbelievably thought that Paul McGann wasn't famous enough or something. I mean, and as everyone always then says, well, we can't complain, we got John Hurt. But I'm just sort of like, well, we could have had four Doctors. We could have had him too, maybe.
Yeah. What's the actual, was that after Eccleston wasn't going to come back?
I believe so.
You make a virtue of, that's a writing thing, isn't it? Make a virtue of your thing. So, okay, well, let's do McGann then. Brilliant. And then not. I mean, hats off to Moffat. I think being told that is, that's not his fault, but the War Doctor was a brilliant, brilliant move. So all these going back to the canon being written for various different reasons and added to, but the War Doctor absolutely is brilliant. And that was another edge of the seat kind of lead up to the 50th.
Yes.
When, you know, I love that whole Clara diving into his time stream. And then that was, you know, there's a few moments where Doctor Who was like, whoa, and I was edge of the seat kind of thing. So that was the 50th. Well, you're right, was that, that's when I, in a weird way, I've always been a Doctor Who, but that's because I was in Manchester. I was writing plays and involved with hardcore Doctor Who fans and conventions. And so that 50th was just insane. Yeah. That whole year was just, and I remember friends of mine, you know, people who'd known me since uni, and one of them was living in LA, And he was, and he sort of just messaged me and went, "What's going on? Doctor Who is in the cinema down the street from me. What the hell's happening?" I went, "Well, Doctor Who's got quite popular." And he went, "I'm going to go and see it." So, you know, he went, you know, and I saw Day of the Doctor in a cinema. Did you see it live at the XL?
No, because I went on the Friday, and then on the Saturday, my sister, I went, a whole load of us went round to my sister's. It was a slightly mortifying story. My brother-in-law is still mortified about this, because I'd invited some, because they had this sort of room downstairs, which was a sort of mini cinema screening room that, you know, seats about eight people, but it was like, "Oh, we're going to go and watch it there." And so I've sort of, you know, brought sort of all my nerdiest friends, and then something went wrong with, I think we'd sort of recorded it, because we started a bit late. Anyway, something went wrong with the recording and we missed the last 5 minutes, and it went to Strictly Come Dancing. And,
no!
But it's okay. And then, because you know, I think everything was a bit sort of primitive recording wise even in those days, but then it's okay. And then my friends and I went back to mine, and we watched it later. But yeah, I think I think it cut out just as the voice of the curator.
So had you heard his voice?
Yes.
So you knew it was Tom.
His voice.
I didn't realize till quite recently, when people are reminiscing, that so many people knew Tom was coming back. And I didn't.
Yes, I didn't. I didn't either.
I'd forgot. It was so well. I mean, that whole Day of the Doctor was a miracle, because I was in a cinema, packed cinema, full of fellow travellers. And I'd been swept along by the story and enjoyed it. And again, it was like when it came back, I was like, "Please don't be shit. Please don't be shit."
Yeah.
And it wasn't. I loved it. And then I'd forgotten. He tricked me into going, "This is just the end. He's just going to say a cool line and then it will go woo." And then Tom's voice coming in, and I burst into tears. I really did.
It was so emotional. It was,
yeah.
You know, and then obviously we watched it later, and I've watched it many times since, and it's beautiful. Because I think I'd tried to avoid every spoilers, but then with The Night of the Doctor, it's sort of like, you know, it suddenly dropped, and it's something you're supposed to watch. And I think sort of because of McGann, and I think he had, you know, I think sort of there had been moments where he'd been sort of confirmed as a definite Doctor, but I think, you know, I sort of feel like it sort of felt a bit like sort of healing a wound that he's definitely in the continuity, and he gets his own, albeit very short, episode. And, you know, we see sort of the older McGann, and it just sort of, I don't know, there was just a sort of, it was just a wonderful, celebratory, positive time to be a fan. And that this just sort of felt like The Night of the Doctor, just like another wonderful, positive, wound healing thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. But also, I mean, had you listened to much of the Big Finish, McGann?
So, of course, the shout out to the companions, and
So that was an extra special cherry on the cake.
Yes.
But now I'm like, well, they need to explain why he doesn't mention Liv and some of the others. Like, what's happened for him not to mention them?
Well, maybe Russell's supposed to be announcing some sort of surprise on the 23rd, so maybe it'll be.
Yeah, here's the story of why the Eighth Doctor and Liv Chenkov fell out. So he didn't think to mention her when he regenerated. But you know, I mean, I would be surprised if Nicola Walker and Paul McGann don't appear on screen together at some point. If I had my way, you know, with the Whoniverse being announced,
yes,
if I had my way, there would definitely be a here is McGann.
Yes.
Really cunningly slotted in with the ongoing continuity, but you know, in that Marvel way of doing things.
Yeah,
here's the Eighth Doctor at the end of his life. Here's where we meet Shooty and it intersects. And I'm just hoping for all these sort of things.
Yes, I think there's all. I think there's all sorts of. Promised all sorts of exciting things. But yes,
yeah, I hope so. But yeah, it's crazy. There were people out there that know. I mean, like, I know Gary Russell quite well, obviously, now through Cutaway and stuff. And the fact that he was sitting, having read the script to write the novelization.
Wow.
He's like, how do you hold those secrets in your head? it's the first one he's written, isn't it? That Gary's written. The Star Beast.
Yes, the Star Beast, then the Giggle, then Into the World. Blue Yonder.
I'm fairly sure Gary has written Star Beast. So he knew. So he knows. He has known for like a year or so whether it's shit or not. and he just wouldn't even know he had any inclination whatsoever. So Gary has written Star Beast, yeah. And it's, but I guess that's all part of it. Because I guess, you know, you get very paranoid about spoilers, especially yes. when it comes to TV, because you would never be forgiven.
No.
for saying something out loud. Unless you're one of the stars. I think Bonnie Langford said too much at a con.
Oh, did she?
but she's Bonnie Langford. So what are you going to do? But if you're just a writer in the minds of Doctor Who, toiling away, you can be replaced. Yes. but I mean, Night of the Doctor was just one of those wonderful things.
Yes.
And then Day of the Doctor as well. It was just immense. But I love the fact that Moffat very cheekily broke Doctor Who rules, so he added the Big Finish stuff.
Yes,
he got the list, but he didn't have it in the script because it's technically against license fee rules.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Because Russell's always in interviews saying you can't have anything, nothing is canon if it can't be accessed by the license fee payer.
Oh.
Kind of the way it is. But then Moffat was like, who cares? It's McGann. I'm going to give something to the fans. What are the names of the companions? Beat them out. but it wasn't in the script because the BBC might have gone funny about it.
but it is
wonderful. Anyway, Emma Reeves, I've taken up quite enough of your time, and you must be one of the busiest people in showbiz.
Not at all. It's lovely to speak to you.
But I've got another one of these today as well, so because I've been so busy. But it's great fun chatting and nattering about Doctor Who.
See you.
A cutaway. But it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. And I will see you in the real world, probably at a BFI.
I'm sure we will.
You have been listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton, produced by James Stevenson of Bamalan Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe.